I'm William Brangham, and this is Horizons. There is a critical need for primary care physicians across this country, but a shortage of doctors and rising insurance premiums is forcing people to forego preventive care altogether. With a growing amount of people in need, why is it so hard to find a doctor? Coming up next.
From the David M. Rubenstein Studio at WETA in Washington, here is William Brangham.
Welcome to Horizons. We do not have enough primary care doctors in America. It's estimated that more than 100 million of us struggle to get basic primary preventive care. That's one in three of us who have a hard time finding a doctor. On one hand, this can be a headache. I mean, ask anyone who has tried recently to find a new practice that'll take their insurance. But more importantly, this lack of primary care is terrible for our health, even deadly. Americans die of preventable, treatable diseases at far higher rates than people who live in other similar nations. Is that all because of access to a primary care physician? No, of course not. But having a regular, ongoing relationship with a doctor is one of the best ways to prevent chronic diseases or to get a handle on an illness before it turns chronic and sends us to the hospital or to the emergency room. This lack of access is only widening. It's projected that in just over 10 years, we'll have a shortage of over 80,000 primary care physicians nationwide. So how did we get into this mess, and how can we get out of it? For that, we are joined by two people with up-close expertise on this. Dr. Lucy McBride is a primary care physician here in Washington, D.C. When she's not caring for patients, she writes a Substack newsletter called Are You OK? And she's out with a new book called Beyond the Prescription. And Renu Rayasam is a senior health correspondent at KFF Health News, and she has covered America's healthcare system for many years, everything from its innovations to its inequities. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for being here. Dr. Lucy McBride, I'd love to start with you. In a column that you wrote recently, you told the story of being in an emergency room with your father, and through those thin curtains that we are all familiar with in a hospital, you overheard a lot of the other patients talking about what had landed them in the emergency room. Tell us about what you heard and why that was striking to you.
What I was listening to as we were awaiting my dad's test results was a set of conversations that underscored how hard it is to see a primary care doctor. These were people whose problems could have been solved easily by a primary care doctor who had time. A pneumonia that perhaps could have been prevented by getting the pneumonia shot. A urinary tract infection that could have been treated by a doctor who had time that same day. I want to be clear, this is not doctor's fault. It is a system-wide problem. And it's not just these patients in the ER that day. This is a known national shortage we're facing.
Renu, just picking up on that, I mean, Lucy's vignette is pointing to this problem that I mentioned before about what happens to people when they don't have access to primary care. Can you just tell us a little bit more for people who might think, oh, so I don't have a doctor, no big deal. Tell us what we know about the downstream consequences of not getting this kind of care.
Yeah, so there's a lot. I mean, Dr. McBride laid it out pretty clearly. So if you have a trusted relationship with your doctor, you are more likely to catch problems before they escalate. And, you know, just one example, there's a lot of reasons why the U.S. had lower COVID vaccination rates than other peer nations. But one reason is that people didn't have access to a primary care doctor, somebody they went to regularly, that they trusted, that could share health information and make sure that they got the shots. And you think about a lot of other crises that we have in the U.S. So maternal mortality is a huge crisis in the U.S. A lot of those complications could be prevented if somebody had access to regular medical care before they got pregnant to make sure they were healthy, access somebody that could help direct them in terms of mental health care and other issues, but somebody to really help catch things, triage care, but somebody you see regularly that can keep tabs on your overall health.
And Dr. McBride, that we know just as you were witnessing with all those people around you and your dad, going to the emergency room, far more expensive. I mean, from a public policy standpoint, having people not get that care and simply waiting till they're so sick, it seems like it's got to cost a fortune.
I'll tell you about a patient I write about in my book, a patient who came to see me after she had been in the ER for abdominal pain. She had a $12,000 evaluation in the ER, was sent home with a diagnosis of non-specific abdominal pain, which anybody
$12,000 for a, we're not quite sure.
It's a description, not a diagnosis, right? She comes to my office. It turns out her mother had just moved in with her, and her mother has Alzheimer's. She's caring for her mother. She's drinking alcohol at night to take the edge off. She's drinking more caffeine in the morning to go to work and focus. She's taking Advil to treat her hips that are hurting her. She didn't need more testing. She needed someone to listen, someone to help connect the dots between her actual problems and the very straightforward levers that I could help her adjust. And she needed someone to shepherd her through the process of understanding how her body was connecting to her social situation. And that is not something you can do in a transaction one time in an ER. And it's certainly more expensive to take those problems to the emergency room than it is to have a conversation with the doctor.
Right, and certainly those are not the kinds of things you might tell an emergency room doctor or might have been thinking about yourself in advance.
Well, they also don't ask. You know, emergency rooms are there to help make sure you're not dying, right? The nuances of what is happening in your actual life are for the primary care doctor. The primary care doctor's role is not just prescriptions and referrals. It's understanding, it's listening, it's empowering you with the tools and information you need to manage risk, risk that shows up later in your life as diabetes, heart disease, dementia. Those things are conversations, but when our system pays for procedures and not conversations, you can see exactly why there are fewer and fewer primary care doctors out there, because it's just not prioritized in our country.
Right. Renu, I know a lot of the reporting you've been doing has been recently reaching out to patients and just trying to gauge from them what their experience of navigating our healthcare system is like. Tell us a little bit about what you've been finding in your reporting.
Sure. So we're doing this series this year called Price Doubt, and it's about people who are trying to navigate the costs of care. And more than 120 people have reached out to us. And what we have found is that cost is by far one of the biggest barriers, cost and coverage. So there are other things that keep people from going to the doctor. Transportation is one, childcare. You know, if you don't have a way to get to the doctor, you don't have someone to care for your kids when they're there, you don't have time off of work. Those are all things that are keeping people from visiting their doctor. But the number one reason is that they just don't have access because they can't afford it, or they don't have health insurance coverage. And to give you some perspective here, you know, the U.S. has, as we all know, just kind of out of control health spending. And what we're seeing now with this administration and with this Congress is that they're not doing a lot to kind of control those overall health costs. What they've done is cut federal health spending and push those costs onto patients. So what does that mean? That means that they've chosen not to extend subsidies for Affordable Care Act plans. They're adding work requirements to Medicaid. They've just kind of overall cut federal health spending. That's leaving a lot of people uninsured or underinsured. So maybe they can afford a plan, but they have a really high deductible. So we've just been hearing from patients all over the country about those struggles. I'll give you one example. Anita Het, she's a retired school nurse in New Mexico, and she wrote to us, and I spoke with her, and she said she had an Affordable Care Act plan, but her subsidies went away this year, so she decided to become uninsured. She has a number of health conditions, and when she said she hasn't been to a primary care doctor, it was actually really interesting. She said, you know, I could negotiate a fee with my primary care doctor and see them, but I know that doctor would order a bunch of labs, and I wouldn't be able to afford those, and that was really striking to me, so she just didn't go.
It's incredible that a nurse who is someone in the healthcare field is pushed to these kinds of extremes. Dr. McBride?
And that's not the only nurse. I talked to another nurse, a travel nurse, who couldn't afford his employer coverage, employer-sponsored coverage. It would have been $5,000 a month to cover him, his wife, and his teen daughter. He had a stroke. He got a bill for $300,000 from the hospital. And it's fascinating. This is a travel nurse. When he was experiencing symptoms of a second stroke, he did it he went to urgent care because he was so scared about the bills. But again, this is somebody who, you know, if you had a trusted provider, you know, could have caught these issues ahead of time.
What Renu is describing, Dr. McBride, are a whole slew of reasons why people would not come to you. The cost, the concern over spiraling surprise bills. What are some of the other things that when you look at our system that makes it so difficult for people to connect to someone like you?
So I think as Renu outlined, cost is a huge factor. A major problem, though, is a shortage of primary care doctors to begin with.
There just are not enough of you out there.
There are not enough. As you outlined in the introduction, by 2037, we're slated to be short something like 87,000 primary care doctors in the U.S. 5% of healthcare spending in the U.S. goes to prevention. Only 5% of healthcare spending goes to prevention. 95% of healthcare spending in the U.S. goes to procedures, hospitalizations, ER visits, and administrative work. So that says a lot about what we prioritize. We don't prioritize preventative care. We prioritize sick care. Then you take the fact that physicians in primary care are reimbursed at a much lower rate than specialists. Specialists make 40 to 90% more money than primary care doctors do. And I'm not
trying to— So if I'm a cardiologist or I'm a dermatologist or something, I'm going to get more reimbursement for my treatment of a patient than if I'm you helping someone with pneumonia, the flu, whatever.
Right. So the conversation with a primary care doctor, an appointment might be reimbursed $250 or so, whereas that same amount of time for a procedure, like treating the heart attack that you might not have had had you had conversations with your primary care doctor, can be thousands of dollars. So what does that do? It incentivizes medical students and residents who are training not to choose primary care. Because if you're forced to see a patient every 15 minutes and you're underpaid and you're faced with a waiting room of patients who are upset at you for making them wait, understandably, you're going to pick interventional right. cardiology or a specialty that treats 2 square inches of the body instead of choosing a field where the relational aspects of care are the most important, yet are not valued according to our payment system.
Renu, help me understand.
And I want to jump in. Can
Please.
I jump in right there
Please.
For a moment? So, you know, just for a bit of history here, because I think everything Dr. McBride said is true. And there are a lot of structural reasons for that. So there was a time in the 80s when many in the country thought we had a physician surplus. I mean, it's hard to imagine because it's not that long ago.
A surplus. We had too many doctors.
Yes, there was like a fear we had too many doctors. And the way that Congress responded to that is they sort of, in a way, capped the amount of residency slots. So Medicare is the country's biggest payer of graduate medical education, not the only payer, but the biggest payer. And they have only raised those caps one time, and that was in 2021. They added about 1,000 slots. They're supposed to be for primary care and to go to rural and underserved areas. Well, what happened, people went into specialties for the very same reasons that Dr. McBride mentioned, that hospitals with these graduate medical programs, they get paid more from the federal government when they do more procedures, which favors specialists. And there's a lot of other kind of things in that funding formula. But if you look at the very kind of structure of how we fund and finance graduate medical education and healthcare across the country, it exacerbates all of these problems that we're talking about today.
Not to mention that graduates coming out of medical school in 2025 carried somewhere between $200,000 to $250,000 worth of debt. So yeah. What are you going to choose? What are you going to choose when you're strapped with debt? And when you're looking at your future, you're going to likely pick something that's procedure-based, not conversation-based.
Dr. McBride, help me understand this, though. We live, I know you're not an economist, but we live in a capitalist society. The law dictates that if there is a demand, it will in time be met by a supply. And Renu was giving us some sense of as to why we are having this difficulty here. But how is it that if we have known for decades now that we need more doctors, why are we not making more doctors?
I mean, that is the million-dollar question that Americans are paying for right this minute. We don't have enough residency spots. We don't
literally not enough spots in medical schools to take students.
In primary care. we don't have enough. We also need loan forgiveness for medical students who are deciding to go into primary care fields, pediatrics, family medicine, internal medicine. And then we need to prioritize prevention. You know, the system is broken by design. No matter what your politics are, it just is. It's broken by design. There's a lot of money being made. There's a lot of money being made by sick care. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. That's just what the data shows. We prioritize damage control medicine and not prevention at the expense of American health. 6 in 10 Americans are walking around with chronic illness. So many elements of chronic disease can be prevented by counseling and education and simple interventions that require a partnership between patient and doctor, empowering people with tools, information, lifestyle advice, you know, psychosocial advice, mental health advice. But if we're not going to decide to pay for medicine and for care like that, you know, we're not going to do any better than we are now in the future.
Renu, again, this I keep asking economics questions here. I know before we're talking about healthcare. Help me understand this. If I am a cold-blooded accountant for an insurance company, I would much rather pay a smaller amount to prevent someone's heart trouble from becoming congestive heart failure than pay for much, much more expensive cardiac intervention, congestive heart failure treatment over the course of that person's lifetime. So why don't those economics seem to drive more money towards prevention?
That's a great question. I mean, in this country, we have what's known as a fee-for-service model. So clinicians get paid based on what they bill, right? Based on the procedures they bill. And, you know, when the Affordable Care Act passed, it tried to kind of introduce what you're talking about, this value-based care model. So let's put more into prevention and save money down the line. But this fee-for-service model is so entrenched within our system that it's really hard to kind of get out of that, right? I mean, this is just how doctors and other clinicians are used to, in hospitals are used to billing their patients. And you think about kind of the economics of primary care. So what's happening across the healthcare industry kind of globally, hospitals, insurers, other big medical groups, they're all consolidating. They all have more market power. This is actually one of the biggest drivers of rising healthcare costs and rising healthcare spending overall today. But you look at these kind of like little independent primary care physician practices, they don't have that same market power, right? So they're, and in this country, healthcare is incredibly fragmented. There's no kind of set prices or anything like that. So each individual clinician has to negotiate with an insurer on, you know, what they're going to get reimbursed for their services. And, you know, insurers are trying to build these networks and they want to have specialists, they want to have other people. And so if you're just this kind of independent primary care doctor out there in the world, you don't have that kind of leverage to be able to negotiate higher rates. And so that's kind of one of the things we're seeing sort of on the business side of things. That's kind of preventing the thing you were talking about, which is, hey, why don't we pay for all this prevention? Well, the system is just not set up for that. And you're right, an insurer should want that, but we just don't see it happening.
The other thing is that for an insurance company to benefit from better reimbursements to primary care, they have to be with that patient over the long term.
Yeah,
in an
exactly.
insurance,
That's exactly right.
In an employer-based insurance system, like where your employer might shift year to year, your insurance company may not see the benefit of the conversation you and I have. If I were your doctor and you were my patient, let's talk about how your stress is affecting your sleep, which is affecting your cognitive health, or let's talk about alcohol or diet, or the myriad questions you have.
Right, you're planting seeds of prevention that'll accrue to some other insurance company.
That's right. So today, you're not motivated as an insurance company to invest in primary care because it's not going to bear fruit till later.
So perverse.
Yeah.
It is
there's
completely perverse.
Churn, right. Yeah. And there's a lot of churn in this system. People switch jobs. Even if you have the same job, your job might switch insurance plans. You might have the same job, same insurance plan, and the insurance company changes the network. I mean, there's an enormous amount of churn in the system as we have it now. And, you know, I will say, like other countries, they're sort of the switching cost is lower. And Dr. McBride's exactly right. I mean, there is an incentive to say, okay, we're going to pay for these visits. We're going to pay for these preventative tests and labs and imaging or whatever. down the line. But in this system, there's just a ton of churn. And so, you know, the likelihood that a patient is with the same insurer for their lifetime is very, very low.
Dr. McBride, I want to read something from your book that seems to point to another one of the factors here. You write in your book, quote, "For doctors like me, the choices have become stark. Stay in a system that rewards volume over relationships and prescriptions over prevention. Find a way to practice medicine differently or leave the profession entirely." I mean, that is a pretty stark choice. It seems to be you're signaling that the idea of practicing medicine, it just burns you out to be a preventative.
The burnout rates are huge. Some recent polling shows that 45% of primary care doctors are burned out, and something like 35% are planning on doing something else with their life. So we go to medical school and we train to become primary care doctors to lay on hands, to shepherd people through sickness and health, to solve problems that you can't measure in a lab test. When you're forced to see an 80-year-old patient who is just diagnosed with cancer, is grieving the loss of their spouse and has chest pain, and you have 15 minutes, there's moral injury. You burn out. Of course, there's moral injury to the patient as well, who's suffering from lack of access to a primary care doctor. But when you're talking about why doctors are frustrated and why they leave medicine, it's for that very reason. The system doesn't allow us to care for patients the way we are trained to and the way we want to. So what do people do? They either leave the field or they do what I've done, which is build their own practice where patients can submit for out-of-network benefits to prioritize the time with patients and the relationship with patients. So instead of having thousands and thousands of patients, you have a couple hundred. But that model is part of the problem here, right? It needs to be scaled nationally so everyone has access to a primary care doctor who knows their name, not just their diagnosis codes. That's part of the solution. When we talk about solutions, we'll talk about what it looks like to actually supply people with primary care, the kind that doctors and patients alike want.
I mean, both of you have been touching on proposed solutions here, both legislative, policy, rewarding prevention versus simply procedures. One of the things that I know that is percolating in the ether is the proposed promise of artificial intelligence and AI, and you hear about this all the time. Lucy, before we started recording, you were telling me about a paper recently written by a fairly prominent person in this field arguing that AI is going to be one of the white knights to come in and save this. What do you make of that? As a practitioner, do you think AI is going to be a net positive for medical care?
So you're right. Zeke Emanuel and colleagues published a piece in JAMA. It was sort of a bombshell piece, arguing that by 2030, AI will likely take over most of doctors' roles. Provocative, lots of conversation in my world about this. So AI is a wonderful thing, but only when it's pointed at the right things. AI is brilliant at answering the question you've asked it. But the art of medicine is surfacing the question the patient actually has, understanding what the problems they have, not just the things that they think they have. It's not to say the patients don't understand themselves. It's to say that the art of medicine is helping connect the dots between their goals, their vulnerabilities, their medical problems, and the things they're embarrassed to say out loud, the things that don't live in a lab test. So I think if you point AI at the administrative churn that has hollowed out primary care in the United States and that has only added to physician burnout, and you allow AI to do a lot of the transactional elements of work that I do, like drafting letters to insurance companies to say, why the heck won't you cover my patient's medication, then you stand the chance of elevating primary care to the true crown jewel of medical care in this country, where it's a relationship and AI is doing everything else.
Right.
But if you point AI at the relational aspects of care, then I think you're basically industrializing a system that is already very broken.
Right. I'm so sorry to say we have to stop here. Such an important conversation. Dr. Lucy McBride and Renu Rayasam of KFF, thank you both so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
And that is it for this episode of Horizons. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week.